A jail stint can really disrupt someone's life. You can lose a job, a relationship, or thousands of dollars on fees, fines, and bail.
Have I ever gone to jail? Yeah, I just got out, actually.
If he doesn't show up to court, you gotta pay the $50,000.
No ring exchange, no kiss the bride. There's no glamour in a jailhouse wedding.
Off the Block. All six episodes tracing the path from city block to jail block and back are now available on KCRW's iTunes page.
Hi, this is Robert Scheer. Welcome to another edition of Scheer Intelligence, where the intelligence comes from my guests, and in this case, it's Elizabeth Mateo, a immigrant activist who has had a rich history ever since she came into this country dealing with immigration laws. She came in at age of 14 from Oaxaca. She went to local schools, graduated from Venice High School, and actually spent 2 years at Santa Monica College, where we're broadcasting from, very proud alumni, and went on then to Cal State Northridge and another great local institution, and then went up to Santa Clara College, a Jesuit institution in Silicon Valley, and graduated from law school, all of which would now put her in a position for a great career, except there's a question about her documentation, which is actually the subject of this podcast. Everybody's now talking about immigration reform or getting rid of immigrants or what have you, and there's a lot of hypocrisy around this issue. But one of the bright spots, although maybe Elizabeth will disagree with me, is that at least here in the state of California, which has been ahead of the country, I think, on immigration reform as far as licenses, and in one bill that Jerry Brown, our governor, signed, you can actually get credentialed as a lawyer and function. So why don't we begin with that? On the one hand, you represent the great achievement of the American melting pot, you know, a person who did everything right, and yet you could have been eligible for the DREAM Act that Obama has proclaimed or seems to support. There's a bit of a mixed record there from Obama on this, which you can discuss. But you have a problem in your record is in that you were an activist and one of your activist actions was to self-deport. So why don't we talk about that?
Yes. First of all, thank you so much for inviting me, for having me here. So yes, I'm essentially what a lot of people call a dreamer. I came to the U.S. at a very young age. I went to high school, college in the area. I graduated from law school. And yes, California has been, I think, at the forefront of immigrant rights issues for a long time. We're able to get in-state tuition, pay like everyone else who's a citizen, also get certain financial aid. And more recently, at least for me, the most, I guess, crucial thing in my career is that I can actually get a license. I can take the bar, get a license, and practice law. The issue right now is that I can't work legally in the U.S. I don't have a work permit because I do qualify, in my opinion, for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, as most people know it, which is a program that President Obama created in 2012. However, as part of my activism, I left the country in 2013 briefly with two other young people. And we joined a campaign called the Bring Them Home campaign. We essentially met with other young people in Mexico who had been deported, who had left for family reasons, for other emergencies, and who wanted to come home. So we came back, the nine of us. We were named the Dream Nine. And we presented ourselves at the border and asked the government to allow us to come home, which they did after 17 days in detention. And so I went on to law school thinking, I'm going to remain in this country. I have been allowed to come home, and I'm going to apply for DACA eventually, which I did, only to receive not one but two notices of intent to deny from the government citing that exit. And so that's what I'm dealing with right now, and that's what I'm fighting for.
So this is a situation that a lot of people fall into, that something has gone awry in their papers, either because they were really great citizens like you, activists to try to make the country better, or they had some technical difficulty. Speaking as a lawyer, what can be done now, not just in your case? Where do we stand on the immigration issue? I know the Democrats are saying they're great on it and they're getting a lot of votes based on that. They weren't always great. And the Republicans are being led by an out-and-out neo-fascist, Donald Trump, who wants to just blame, when he's not blaming Muslims, he wants to blame immigrants, undocumented immigrants, for all of our problems, when, of course, they have nothing to do with it. So we're in a weird place where the good people haven't always been so good.
Yeah, and that's a problem, especially during this election that has been very negative, where immigrants have been described with some of the most horrible words. But I think, at least for me, not so much from a standpoint of a law graduate or a future lawyer, but more from a standpoint of an immigrant and an organizer, I think that we need to be ready regardless of who becomes president. Even if it's Hillary Clinton, she is saying some great things about immigrants now, but she hasn't always been on our side. She was the first one to call for the deportation of minors, refugee children from Central America. She has agreed with the policies of President Obama to deport almost 3 million people at this point, 2.5 million people, including many of those refugee children, many of who are still in jails across the country at this point. And that's, to me, that's just unacceptable that in this country we put kids in jails, in prisons. So I think whoever becomes president, we just have to be ready to keep organizing like we have so far. And I think, and that's part of the reason why I'm speaking out on my case, and why the government wants to deny me a benefit that, one, I qualify for, and two, that I think I have worked very hard for, and have in many ways earned through my activism, through my work in, you know, my personal life. And that's the kind of message that I'm trying to send to the community at this point.
You know, living here in Los Angeles and running into a lot of people, students of my own at USC and elsewhere who have questionable status, they're a little angry with Obama. And some of them, my students, have called him the deporter in chief.
He's the president who has deported more undocumented immigrants in the history of this country. And that's in
more than any other president.
Yeah, more than any other president. And that's in great contrast with what he campaigned around in 2008. A lot of young people, a lot of dreamers went out and supported his campaign, knock on doors, encouraged people to vote for him. So we felt in many ways betrayed by the promises that he was making, and felt like DACA, while it was great, it wasn't enough. Because we were still seeing our parents, our neighbors, our friends getting deported. And that's the reason we did this campaign, the Bring the Home campaign, to try to reunite some of these young people who have been deported, and also work with families to come back home. Because it was very frustrating to hear people who were in Mexico or another country saying, I want to come home. I have kids in the U.S. My parents are in the U.S. I'm a dreamer. I grew up there since I was two, and I hardly speak Spanish, and I don't know what I'm doing here. I was deported. I want to come home. And that's the reason we did it, because we wanted to show the Obama administration that they can do more, that DACA was great, but it's not enough, that there's some more that we can do. And that was the main reason.
And were you, but you knew at the time that you were risking your status, or?
Yeah, I had been in the country, in the U.S., living in the U.S. for about 15 years at that point. So I knew that it was going to be risky. I knew that there was a chance that I wasn't going to be able to come back. But I was also very inspired and hopeful that my community was going to rally around our cause and understand what we were trying to do, and basically organize to get us back home. We had been able to, at that point, we had been able to stop a lot of deportations with the help of the community, by organizing. And we, I think we were inspired by that, and we wanted to take that to a different level and show our community more than anything that when they organize, that when they work together, they can do lots of things that they didn't think they could.
You know, I must say, this is a big part of the California story, and that's not been recognized nationally enough, that the reason California, and one of the consequences of its change, is that it's a deep blue state, and the Republicans are in danger now of being a third party with undecided about to be more successful, a larger group than Republicans. And what happened is the Republicans backed a Proposition 187, which was a draconian proposition. It wasn't the first one, but it was the nastiest one, and it passed. And then it was thrown out by the courts. But it identified, it gave the Democrats an opportunity to show a different way, and they did. The Democratic Party in California broke with actually the National Democratic Party, broke with its tradition, because in the Democrats, because of a narrow-minded labor movement of old, including the farm workers at one point, thought that immigration was threatening, immigrants were threatening to their effort. That changed. And in California, as you mentioned, with the rights that undocumented people have in California, the Democratic Party decided very clearly to establish a commitment to the human rights of undocumented people. And I remember looking out of my window. I lived downtown in Los Angeles, and you reminded me, oh, it was 06. 06, I looked out of my window. I had no advance notice. I don't know. I read the papers. I follow the news. And I suddenly saw the largest demonstration I've ever seen in Los Angeles going right under my window. And I go, what is this thing about, you know? And they were all streaming towards City Hall, down First Street and everything. So I went running out to find out what it was about. And it was a demonstration for saner immigration rules, immigration rights. But what it represented was a unification of not only the immigrant community, the Latino community, but also, you know, ending of this, oh, I'm a citizen, I don't care about you, or I have this status. It ended a certain kind of individualism and development of a sense of community that I think was quite startling. Was that the pivotal moment?
I think that it was one of the pivotal moments. I think that 2006 demonstrated to the community that it's possible to work together, that it's possible to unify and to work towards what we want, which is to be treated with dignity and respect. But I think that after that point, there were several others. And I think in 2010, there were some major demonstrations, not at a level with hundreds of thousands of people, but 2010 was a year that I think we at least undocumented, you coined undocumented and unafraid to mean we're not going to be afraid to say we're undocumented. We're not going to be ashamed to say we're undocumented. We're going to take pride in that. And we're going to push our stories and the stories of our parents to the mainstream so that they know that we exist, so that they know, and by they, I mean the country knows that that we exist, that we are part of this country, that we contribute, and that we deserve to be treated as human beings, that we deserve to have some kind of legal status, some kind of protection, that our families deserve to stay together. So I think after 2010, there's been several other demonstrations by undocumented youth, by our parents in the South also. It's not just California, but in Alabama, for example, parents voluntarily getting arrested to fight against some of the most hateful legislation in Alabama. Like that to me has been one of the most inspiring moments of my life. And so I think there's been several for sure.
This is Robert Shear. I'm talking about Elizabeth Mateo, an immigrant activist, a graduate of law school now, and someone who is bucking the system. And this is a show on American originals. Why out of the crazy quilt of our immigrant background and everything else, do we get unique individuals who stand up and stand for something and not just their own personal ambition? And in your case, I would consider you an original American because, after all, you're a Zapoteca from, you know, Oaxaca. You're, I gather, indigenous.
Yes.
Yes. And you even know a pre-Spanish language, which is, I see something of a revival among younger people trying to learn indigenous languages that in some cases were disappearing. Mm-hmm. And so you are one of the original Americans. It's just an accident of border that you're not considered entitled to have a casino or something if we take that kind of advance as an advance. And so let me ask you about your story. Weren't you in part tempted to do something that I think, unfortunately, we teach too often in our schools, that careerism should trump anything else, that you had a good career before you? Why didn't you sell out? I guess is the answer. Why did you take this additional burden? You know, because otherwise you are on your way to being a very successful lawyer. Why did you endanger that?
I think I've been able to get as far as I've been able to get because there's been a lot of people who have supported me, who have helped me, who have believed in me. And I wholeheartedly believe in returning that favor, in paying it forward. I know that I didn't get where I am. I didn't go to law school just out of my own effort. Obviously, I had to work really hard. I had to work harder than most of my peers. But there were a lot of people who believed in me. And those are the people that have lifted me, who have put me in the places where I've been able to go. And I honestly feel like I'm part of something bigger than myself. And my parents have always been very kind people, very generous. And they've taught me to care about other people as well, to care about my community, to care about my environment and not just impressions that I make on people, but what I can do to better that environment. And I think that's why I didn't want to just continue my education on my own without being able to not necessarily inspire, but help other individuals get the same benefits, the same rights that I do enjoy. I think that we're stronger as a community, and I will be able to get farther in life if I'm not seen as an exception, if I'm not seen as, because I was told many, many times, those immigrants, we don't support them. We don't believe that they're good for the country, but you're different. So growing up in Venice, in the Venice area, in Culver City, I had a lot of friends who will say things like that about my parents, you know, people like my parents. Well, we don't agree with immigrants. I think they should be deported. But you're different. And so I think that's also what inspired me to kind of show my community, the rest of my community, the rest of the country, that there's no such thing as good or bad immigrants. We all have something to contribute. And there's plenty of people in our communities that are doing amazing, amazing work. And I wanted to showcase and highlight those stories as well.
This is Sheer Intelligence. My guest is Lisbeth Mateo. We'll be right back.
Check out KCRW's All News Channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more. 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
We're back with another edition of Sheer Intelligence, and my guest is Lisbeth Mateo. Let me ask you, what is the impact of Trump's attack? I mean, it is so vicious, so low level, so, you know, evil. I use neo-fascism because, after all, what was fascism? It was blaming the other, Jews, gypsies, homosexuals, blaming the other for the economic problems, the social disarray of your society. And suddenly Trump was doing it. You know, wow, we need this wall. Well, these people are rapists. We have to get rid of them. And this is permanent, is it?
I would think so. I think that it is. People won't forget easily. People will not forget. Trump may disappear. Who knows if he's going to win? But let's say that he doesn't win. He's going to go back to do whatever he wants to do. He's going to disappear. But the Republican Party is going to continue with that, having that image of those who just stood there, while allowing Trump to say all kinds of awful things about immigrants, about women. So I think it is permanent. Our communities will remember. There's obviously some fear And that's unfortunate. Some people are fearing that Trump is actually going to build the wall, or that he's going to actually deport people. But I think one thing that we're forgetting is that that's actually happening. There's more militarization at the border. There's less and less people coming from Mexico. There's more people who are leaving the country, actually, leaving the U.S. and going back to Mexico. There's been almost 3 million deportations under a Democrat, President Obama. So that's happening. But I think what's going to last is that we're not going to forget what Trump said. We're not going to forget what the Republican Party said. And we're not going to forget what the Democrats did or said in response to that. And I think that, and my hope is that that fear and that anger that we feel right now for being called rapists and criminals and all kinds of awful things, that they will translate into empowerment, that will translate into actually organizing to say, okay, Trump said all these things, but if Hillary wins, what is she actually going to do? Not anymore what she's going to say, but what is she going to do for us? Because there's a lot of people out there who cannot vote, but who are campaigning for Hillary, who are encouraging their friends and their neighbors and their community to vote for Hillary Clinton. So I think that whoever becomes president, especially if Hillary Clinton becomes president, she needs to take the community seriously, and she needs to actually do something to pay back what we've done for her, what our community has done for her.
Even the traditional trade union movement in this country was not welcoming to immigrants from anywhere, whether they were from Ireland or they were from China. So, because it thought if you increase the pool of workers, they'll be exploited more readily. And that argument came to be dropped to a large degree. It's still, unfortunately, applied. And I was wondering if there aren't things that can be done in that respect in terms of saying, okay, let's increase the minimum wage and let's enforce it.
Yeah.
Okay. That, to my mind, that's like a no-brainer. Okay. Let's have something that approximates a living wage. That means people earning that will not become dependent.
No, and I agree. I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done. Unfortunately, I think that sometimes employees are the ones that get punished instead of employers who violate the laws. And I think that I agree those laws need to be enforced. There is a need to have a higher wage. California is a very expensive place. LA is a very expensive place to live. And the minimum wage that we have is not quite enough for a family, for parents who have children. So I do agree that those laws need to be enforced. And I think that when we think of low-wage workers, we need to think of them as part of our communities, because I think that there's sometimes that divide of, well, they don't have documents, so they can't really demand higher wages. They can't really demand to be treated, to be protected by the laws that we have. But I think, at least in the state of California, it's made very clear that the laws, and especially labor laws, apply to all workers, apply to all people who are part of our working force. So I do agree that those need to be enforced, and there needs to be a recognition that immigrants contribute a lot. Whether they're working in a restaurant, in a factory, at a school, whatever it is they're working, or even in the underground economy, they still contribute. We still pay taxes. We're not able to get a lot of services, a lot of benefits, like going to hospitals, for example, but we can. In this country, the irony is that we can get a IT number, which is kind of like a social security number, and pay taxes. And a lot of people that I know, a lot of immigrant families have done that. And the reason they've done that is because they have the hope that someday they're going to be able to legalize their status. And the way that they're going to prove what they've contributed, what they've how long they've been in this country, and that they've been good citizens, is by showing the government all these tax forms, all the taxes that they've paid.
So the question is, what will be the pressure on the people who, both Republican and Democrats, who are running this country after? And clearly for the Democrats, and I know you will remind them, Hillary Clinton wouldn't have won those primaries without a big brown as well as a black support base expecting some progressive legislation.
Yeah, no, and I think that the community will certainly remind Hillary Clinton that they've been there for her and that she needs to be there for us now. And I think that's the reason why I'm speaking out on my own case, even though it's my application for the FOR Action that's being tentatively denied by the government, which is very ironic because not just my work, but the work of a lot of people like myself helped create that program, right? And I feel like I'm being punished for wanting to create more protections for immigrant families and trying to reunite some of these families that the administration has deported. But I think we're going to remind Hillary Clinton that we're not going to allow anyone, just like we've done with Trump. I mean, there's been a lot of demonstrations against him. There will be demonstrations and work done to make sure that Democrats don't continue to just pay lip service to us, that they actually do something, you know, the things that they've promised us, not just for the immigrant community, but for workers, for women, for the LGBT community, because we're all a part of that, of those communities, and we care about those issues as well.
So let's conclude by giving people a very clear idea of your case. Not because, you know, one human being is more important than others, but sometimes there's a case that galvanizes public attention. It's a way of defining issues. And you're a person who has done all the right things that we expect from a contributing citizen or person in our society, right? You are the model. So why don't we go through this? Why? What is it precisely? Because I think we didn't get it as clearly as we need to. But I just want to be clear about this because I think your case is compelling. That's why I wanted to interview you. So just take us through the ABCs of what happened to you and what you're facing now and how people can support you.
Yes. So people can go to pangealegal.org. That's the website of the nonprofit that's representing me with my Defer Action application. So in 2015, I applied for Defer Action for childhood arrivals or DACA, which will give me protection from deportation for 2 years, and it will give me a work permit, allowing me to use my legal degree, my law school degree. So in May, I received the first letter of intent to deny, citing my exit and my activism as the reason why the government is intending to deny me this benefit. We reply because they asked us to respond to that letter. We reply with 90 pages of, you know, letters of support and
petitions. Well, summarize the reply.
So we replied, citing that we that the reason I left was as part of a campaign, as part of
you self-deported.
I self-deported. Yes, I self-deported in 2013. I was absent for 13 days, which is a very brief period of time. I wasn't gone forever. Then when I came back as part of a campaign to reunite families. And that's what we were able to do. And I say we because it wasn't just me. There were other people who were also involved. And then I got another letter of intent to deny in September, citing the same reason for the possible denial. So at that point, we decided to respond, but also launch a campaign. So that's where people can go to pangealegal.org and find out more about it. We have a petition. We've been able to gather almost 3,000 signatures from the community. Over 40 organizations across the country have signed on to a letter asking the government, the Obama administration, to grant me DACA. Over 250 law professors, many immigration experts and attorneys have also signed a letter asking the Obama administration to grant me Defer Action. So we're launching this campaign in a way to not just win something for myself, not just to get me a work permit or get me protection under DACA, but to also tell the immigrant community, especially young people, that they should not be afraid to continue to organize.
Well, and clearly you are someone with a skill set now that we need. You're a lawyer who graduated a very prestigious law school. You're bilingual. You know a history of your own people back in Mexico and Oaxaca. You can communicate with this very large community that we need to communicate with, that needs legal representation, that has dealings with the courts, that needs people, lawyers who can understand the case and explain it. So clearly, you're the model citizen that we should be attracting from all over the world. And I would recommend, that people take your case as a test case, not just because you're a delightful, intelligent person. I agree with you. It can't be just about one person. But if this administration, Democrats, which will be continued, presumably in the White House by another Democrat, which has turned down your request. So they have campaigned on the idea that they made progress, significant progress, with these executive orders and so forth from President Obama. If it's a Hillary Clinton that comes in, and presumably there will be people in the lower levels of the ticket that will also get an edge, maybe they'll increase their representation in the House and the Senate. And if they can't provide justice to someone like yourself, right? And I would remind people, what you did is you self-deported, something the Republicans have actually called for, Donald Trump even mentioned. You did that to help other people, not to help yourself, not because you suddenly wanted a Mexican vacation or even that you had to visit a sick relative. But you did this as an act of altruism to help people to unite their families, to call attention to their situation. You risked your status going across the border for 13 days to help others get back in. There should be a statue to you someday. No, really, that's an exemplary behavior, right? And it will be a real test. I would suggest people who listen to this should follow it, see what happens here, whether the new administration, whichever, if it's a Republican, Democrat, but particularly if it's a Democrat, because they've said they have a much better position on this whole issue, deliver. And you would be a very good case. There'll be others to see whether they deliver, because we can't go on saying, oh, we respect immigrant rights, but then I can be the deporter in chief because I'm better than the other one. I'm the lesser evil. That's not enough. If the lesser evil deports 2-3 million people, that's a substantial amount of evil in terms of what harm it brings to people. So I hope people keep in mind the fate of Elizabeth Mateo. Her case, not again just because she's so exemplary, but because it will tell you whether any administration that comes into power is really serious about dealing with what is, for this country, its fundamental, most pressing human rights issue, in my view. So thank you for being here.
Thank you. This is
another edition of Sheer Intelligence. Our producers are Joshua Sheer and Rebecca Mooney. The engineers at KCRW are Kat Yor and Mario Diaz. See you next week.